So welcome to this week's anime podcast. This week we have a rather broad subject to discuss, which is nihilism, again another ism, or as I call it, the ideology of incels, but we'll get into that in a second. This week it is myself, Alex, with the handle The Incels of Sils Maria. You'll figure out what that means later on. We also have Will, who goes under The Gayest Science.
Only the very gayest, like superlatively gay. I'm drinking coffee this week because I've decided that's a healthy alternative to Monster energy drink. I don't know why I formed this hypothesis. I'm going to stick by that. Coffee is healthy.
Compared to what you usually drink, yes. That's
compared
true.
To what I usually drink.
That's all that matters. Everything is relative anyway, as we'll learn from nihilism. we also have Thus Queefed Zarustra, I can't even pronounce it. And that's James. How you doing, James?
What's up, everybody in the house tonight? What's up?
One of the greatest summertime anthems, which we'll post in the links at the bottom of the podcast. It's a very, very broad subject. I suppose what we should do is begin at the beginning, which is when's the first time somebody fucking used the term nihilist. As far as I'm aware, and I'm sure Will, who knows everything about this fucking subject, will correct me, but in the 1860s, there was a book called Fathers and Sons, or something along those lines, where a character refers to himself as nihilist and explains it by saying, effectively, he wanted to destroy all structures and remake a society. Basically, that's what he said of it at the time. Again, Will will correct it and add all ridiculous amounts of side stories, but from what we know, other than that, what are the roots of nihilism? And whoever wants to speak, go.
I suppose there are like various sorts of nihilism. So like you've got like epistemic nihilism, which is the view that like, you know, you don't believe in anything or whatever. And then you've got existential nihilism, which is like human life has no value, or life is not worth living. Then you've got moral nihilism, which is sometimes expressed as moral relativism, which will say something like, there are no moral truths, or there's no moral standard by which we could be held to account. Sometimes I like the Turgenev reference. That was like a really good one that you made. The author Dostoevsky wrote a massive unfinished book called The Brothers Karamazov. And there's this line which is said to be in it. And I've read this book and I know it's not in it. But sometimes people say, oh, this comes from Dostoevsky. But it doesn't seem to unless I've got a bad translation. But Dostoevsky's character says at one point, God is dead, all is permitted. And this is sometimes like seen as being like a nihilistic kind of battle cry of like, you know, anything goes. If like God is dead, then nothing is true, which means everything is valid. So sometimes like that's kind of like the nihilist's rallying cry. I think the thing we're trying to talk about is like I've been kind of going on the rage, like listening to various podcasts on nihilism and trying to like work out what the topic is. And I think the thing that we're talking about, James might correct me, is something like moral nihilism, that there is no objective truth, or like no objective moral truth, or that life has no inherent value, or like life isn't worth living. And I suppose like the root of that, or like the philosophical root of that, comes from Schopenhauer, who really stole it from Hindus and Buddhists, classic like Western appropriation of like other people's culture. But like super quickly, because I don't want to like bore people with Schopenhauer, because Schopenhauer is shit and he's a shit philosopher and no one should read him. But Schopenhauer said something like, life is a pendulum swinging eternally between boredom and suffering. And his argument for this was, you cannot help but want things. Physiologically, you cannot help but want things. Like wanting things seems to be a constitutive feature of being a human being. When you want, you are suffering in a small way, or a great way, depending on what you want. If I want like a delicious Monster energy drink from my fridge, I'm having withdrawal symptoms like live, then that's like a small amount I'm suffering. When I satisfy that want, I don't like experience happiness really. All I experience is temporary alleviation of suffering. So that if we're talking about a numerical scale, want puts me on a negative number. So like I want something, I satisfy that want, and that brings me up to zero. But according to Schopenhauer, who's just fucking wrong, you never get into a positive number. So I think that's the kind of nihilism we're talking about, maybe. But maybe not. Maybe James will have a clearer answer to that.
Like, yeah, I mean, James picked the topic, so we should probably see what he thinks it is. I remember when we were living together years and years ago, he had all these great kind of comic, I don't know what they're called, but they're basically little comics about philosophers. And he had fucking like 1,500 of those.
So probably the logic comics.
Yeah, those ones, yeah. So he knows his stuff. So James, let's see what you think are the roots of nihilism, what nihilism is to you.
So the roots of nihilism, I think, are inherent within the sort of human condition. And when you look at, say, Greek philosophy, there is plenty of proto-nihilism in there, with, you know, certain Greek philosophers having complete Morrissey-style lyrics about how they should be throwing themselves into the sea and stuff like that. And you sort of see it disappear with the ascent of Christianity, largely, in Europe anyway. I wouldn't want to say outside of that, because it's not where my area of expertise lies at all. So as far as I know, nihilism could be very prevalent within like Hindu philosophy or something. But in Europe, with the ascent of Christianity and its moral system, it pretty much disappears until, the Enlightenment. And when the Enlightenment starts taking off, it starts eroding these structures of Christian mythology. And I think the reason that I picked this topic is because I think these last three episodes, including this one, have the same, we're talking about the same thing overall, where, you know, we talked about how civilizations collapse, and the fact that we're sort of seeing the beginning of a civilization collapse is indicative of what the libs are, which is what we talked about yesterday, but also like nihilism is pretty much the main philosophy of the 20th and 21st century. It sort of dictates everything that we see, and it's this overarching thing in our lives. And so I think Nietzsche is a very complicated philosopher, but I think he's, you know, he was very prophetic in quite a lot of ways, when he basically said that, like, you're going to land up in these really weird situations when you have no assigned morality anymore. And when you're going to have to start making up your own ones, you're going to find that that's quite difficult. And that's exactly where we're finding now. And as leftists, we're often making moral arguments. We usually are based in the morality of wealth and things like that. And in some ways, it's a hindrance. In other ways, it's our biggest strength. So the reason that I sort of picked anarchism is it's, in one way, nihilism is our enemy, but it also can be a strength for us, because it allows us to view the world in a specific lens that, you know, is in some ways counteractive to a materialist lens. And it can give us some ideas and thoughts of how to start proceeding forward, and what those are we'll get into as we proceed into the episode.
Before I turn to Will Boy with all of his knowledge about nihilism and about Mr. Nietzsche, because he has a whole fucking bookshelf behind him coated with Nietzsche, I should try and maybe interject a bit of historical materialism, or at least materialism, the history of the kind of late 19th century should be thrown in there, because Nietzsche doesn't come out of nowhere. None of these people came out of nowhere. So you have late 19th century, when he's active, you have the rise of nation states, both Italy and Germany come into being, and Germany being most important, of course, because of where Nietzsche was from. You have industrialization, for the most part, by the late 19th century, had touched most parts of Western Europe, parts of Eastern Europe. You have simultaneously a kind of weird thing, because you have some evangelical movements emerging out of America and in Britain as well. I assume there must have been something going on in Germany. But overall, there's an increasing level of disbelief, in, let's just say, in all aspects of kind of traditional Christianity. So all those things are going on at the same time. Basically, modernity is coming into being. And so figures like Nietzsche were probably not that unusual. They were kind of responding to material realities. And obviously, in his case, he's a very extreme example of what can happen if you have a personality like Nietzsche's combining with all these material changes. But the idea of kind of no of there nothing being true and basically creating your own religion, I suppose, creating your own ism anyway, was certainly not something he was alone in doing. People like Marx at the same time, Freud, were all kind of coming up with these ideas at the same time. So I think it is a reflective of what materially was changing in Europe and in the world at the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's like really great, right? So like Freud knew about Nietzsche and Freud wrote about Nietzsche quite a lot. I think it's important to state like Nietzsche was not a nihilist. So like Nietzsche's entire project from his third major work, which is Untimely Meditations, through to like his not so gradual fall into insanity, and was all concerned with overcoming the problem of nihilism. So Nietzsche was a big fan of Schopenhauer when he was younger, and he thought Wagner was basically Schopenhauerian music made manifest. And he kind of fell out of love with Wagner, and probably relatedly with Schopenhauer at the same time. And Schopenhauer was a massive nihilist. And afterwards, Nietzsche dedicates his entire project to how do we overcome the problem of nihilism. But James is absolutely right. So like Nietzsche's got this big concern that no one really believes in God anymore, but everyone is still following essentially Christian value systems. So like everyone has this depth commitment, or everyone has these like surface rules that presuppose this depth commitment to a belief in God, but they don't have the corresponding depth commitment. So what do we do? What do we do when that happens? And Nietzsche's kind of worry is that with modernity and liberal democracy, everything's going to become trivialized and stupid, and everything's going to become celebrated where it shouldn't be. And we're going to, like, instead of provoking greatness, which was Nietzsche's only concern, how do we construct a society that is capable of producing greatness? And he thought the kind of democracy you have in Europe, because it's so vulgar and crass, we don't have the structures available to do that. So I think that sounds right to me. I suppose like I want to find out from James a wee bit more about what he means when just so like purely so understand like the terms being used, like what he means when he says nihilism is the philosophy of the 21st century. Because I think I agree, but I just want to like make sure I understand kind of what James means by nihilism.
Yeah, I mean, I think nihilism is a nebulous term, and it is difficult to always get a handle on it. And as you were saying earlier, there's these different types of nihilism. But I think the most useful way to put it in is that a belief that there is no inherent morality to the system of life, or you know, there isn't any overarching structure to it, so it is meaningless. There is no God, there is no judgment for your actions in a material, in an ethereal sense. It's you know, what you see is kind of what you get in a large sense. So that's the way that I would use it. And I think you're right, Will, when you say that someone can't be a nihilist, because it would be pretty difficult to believe in absolutely nothing. But I think most people have a strain of nihilism in them. And I do think it is basically true that the world has no meaning, and it is just a void that, you know, nature has created for us. And overall, that if it's a good thing or it's a bad thing, it depends where you're standing and what you believe.
Just to kind of add something there, could it be possible that really what we're talking about is the response, like, not just to take words out of it, like the term nihilism out of it, that the response to, again, a phrase by Nietzsche, the death of God, or the basically the slow death of a sense of spirituality and a replacement by kind of consumerism and modernity, that the response to that is really what has been the 20th and 21st century, rather than nihilism. So basically, is there a broad societal rejection of those ideas? And what comes out of that? Does, you know, militarism, nationalism, fascism, communism, neoliberalism, does that all coming out of that death of the old churches and the old way of thinking. Is that kind of what we're talking about? James.
Well, I mean, the reason that I say that is, you know, the effect that Nietzsche and then people like him and had on existentialism as a philosophy, and the effect that that then had on art throughout the 20th century, you know, pretty much leading to postmodernism and, you know, a lot of good stuff, a lot of bad stuff. In that sense, you know, it was the philosophy of the 20th century. And in the 21st century, the reason it's so important is because we have seen the rise of politicians that effectively are nihilists. Like someone like Obama, who got into power and he doesn't believe in anything. There's no reason that he just wanted to be in power. He just was more interested in his own legacy. And, you know, Obama always looked at what he was doing almost from the third person about, you know, how would this look in 20 years when I write my next book? So he wasn't too interested in actually changing anything. Or to put it in a UK perspective, David Cameron, like, the reason that austerity happened was not because I think that, you know, someone like David Cameron and Osborne are like someone like Thatcher, who have these ideologies that they work from. They don't believe in ideologies. They're only interested in making material wealth from themselves and maybe their pals that they do blow with at the weekend. And so austerity was just what they fell back on. They didn't believe in it. It was just because it was what some economists told them to. And so, you know, they're nihilists in the sense that they don't believe in anything or society or morals, or it's just, you know, they'll do whatever they want to do. And I think the way, you know, the reason that you have something like the Columbine shooting massacre, if you spend the time, and I don't really advise it because most of it is quite boring, but if you watch their home videos and like read their diaries and things like that, they're about as close to an actual sort of like Dostoevsky character that you could get in real life. They live in a completely devoid society where no one's interested in them, thus they're not interested in anyone else. They've got no links to a community or anything like that to the people around them. And so that's how you can end up going into a school and shooting it up like that. It's because, yeah, they were effectively like an actual nihilist character. So, you know, that's why I think it's important to look at it in that sense.
Yeah, so like I suppose like I'm confused by Obama and David Cameron for like a number of reasons, because like they do seem to have like no underlying core values, or like there's no teleology to what they're doing, right? Like there's no like end state they're trying to get to. I suppose like if they believe in anything, it's their own like progression or like their own sense of self. So Obama doesn't really care about cutting this or cutting that or bombing this or bombing that. What he cares about is how he looks in 100 years time. So he believes in like his own worth, or he believes that the thing that is valuable is power and the perception of being powerful. And yeah, is that nihilistic? Well, it might be. I suppose if you're going to define nihilism in a really loose way to mean something like you only have one value, like that sounds kind of strange to me. And it sounds like not nihilism. It sounds like maybe iconoclasticism, sure, but not nihilism. But if we're going to take nihilism to mean something like that, then yeah, that does sound true. I suppose like nihilism is going to speak an awful lot to how we've reacted against this attitude where nothing in the world means anything really, because it's all just atoms configured in a variety of ways. And what capitalism does is it deterritorializes. That sounds like very Deleuzian. I hate Deleuze. Deterritorializes any kind of meaning and turns things into consumer products. So like rosary beads were a massive fashion statement in the 80s for some reason. They were like really cool to wear. And what it did was it decontextualized and like ripped any kind of possible meaning rosary beads might have. Like these kind of Catholic, you guys live in Ireland, you'll know what rosary beads are. But these kind of like Catholic things, and capitalism like strips it of its meaning. So I can totally see why like that might be considered nihilistic. So yeah, like that makes a lot more sense to me. I suppose like a lot of Alex was mentioning fascism and communism. I wonder if the appeal of these moves or like movements is that they try to re-infuse the world with a meaning where there might not be any in the way that people want there to be. And I think that's like a really interesting thing to say. And not from me, from Alex, I mean.
Yeah, no, I think that's the major thing that comes out of it, which is why is this starting when it does in the mid to late 19th century? I think it's all to do with the death of, I mean, it's been already been, some say it was the Enlightenment killed it off, but really it was industrialization and kind of, you know, the removal of the peasant population from the countryside into the cities, the kind of mass literacy that came about by the mid to late 19th century. Awareness of, you know, all these things are going on. And I think it's a hugely revolutionary time in Ireland as well, for the same reason that, you know, there's a kind of colonial struggle going on too, and a kind of educated kind of bourgeois who are addressing problems of colony, etc. But in terms of why I think it's important to understand, you know, that transition, is it also leaves a huge gaping hole in kind of, I don't know, you kind of have to imagine we had like a fifth limb and we just hacked it off, and there's this sense of loss with it, with kind of loss of kind of a certain purpose to your life. Like, I mean, for a very long time, I don't know, thousands of years, religion of one sort or the other provided meaning. You usually, it was a test for another life. There was two lives. There was the life that was short, that was brutal, that was full of suffering and unpleasantness for a lot of people, you know. The average life expectancy being 25 to 30 for most of human history, you know, that's the truth, you know. And, you know, a good half of your kids would die. That was, again, the truth, you know, for humans. So that provided, you know, religion, as Marx said, you know, wasn't, you know, was a chain. You know, if life is a chain, or, you know, the reality of life is a chain, the flowers that grow in the chain our religion. For obvious reasons, we concocted it to give us a sense of security and comfort in the horribleness of life. So to rip that off, like a limb hacked off, it has to be replaced by something. You can't just imagine humans are going to be fine with that. Even if it's something that's inevitable, you have to replace it with something. And so you have nationalism, someone coming into the place of that. You have fascism, which was very religious. It's dripping with the type of idolatry that was there before. Communism the same. I mean, by communism, I mean Stalinism, rather than communism we believe in. And the same even with the commercialism of the present day. It's filled with these kind of sense of, you know, with the people who go on to some of these talent shows. There's almost a sense of religious worship going on. This person's going to become something bigger than what they are. They're going to become a celebrity, you know. So I think that it's an attempt to try and fill that. And in the same way that the religious conflicts of the 1500s and 1600s were unbelievably violent and bloody, in the same way you have the wars of the early to mid 20th century, and if you include the Cold War beyond that. So I think that there's a lot going on there that you know, starts in the late 19th century, you know.
Yeah, I was largely going to say much of the same about how humans clearly have an inbuilt need to believe in something greater than humanity, and like human history and its relation to magic and religion and things like that is just like, it's an indisputable fact. And what's interesting about existentialism, or more the fact is nihilism, is it's your first step on to something else, you know. And that's not to say that there isn't God or anything like that. Not that I believe in it, but, you know, like, there's plenty of anarchists that do believe in stuff like that. But like, I think it's a hugely empowering thing in the end, because, you know, 300, 400 years ago, you would be born and you would have, your morality is made up by the church. And so something like, you know, homosexuality is a sin, even though that's not anywhere in the old, well, it is in the Old Testament as well, actually, isn't it? But yeah, the That's just something. That's an immutable fact. It's a terrible thing, even though that humans are not built up that way, clearly. So something like nihilism at first can be quite scary because you're like, oh, wait, I don't, there isn't actually any meaning to it. But it, what it does is give you the ability to give meaning that is a better one than the one that's prescribed of society. And for us, capitalism, I know this is not original thought at all, but capitalism is our religion. And, you know, look at the corona crisis, the amount of hundreds of thousands of people that are going out to die for an imaginary line. The stock market is just as fantastical and ridiculous to believe in a big bloke with a beard in the sky. So, you know, who's to say in 300, 400 years, they won't be looking back at the corona crisis the same way that we look back at something like the Spanish Inquisition? You're just like, this is fucking insanity. What's wrong with you people?
I suppose the key question for us is, how does this tie in with anarchism, which again, Bakunin was arising at the same time. Obviously, the First International was around the same time Nietzsche was. So how does this tie in? I suppose, because to be honest with you, no offense to any, you know, the use of the term nihilism, but I think a lot of what we're talking about is actually existentialism. And I think a lot of people, when they talk about nihilism, actually confuse it for existentialism to such an extent that most of the podcasts and documentaries I watched in preparation for this were actually just talking about existentialism, really. In fact, one was on YouTube, was called Nietzsche Documentary, and it literally was about Sartre. It didn't mention Nietzsche at all. It was just all about Sartre. Anyway, and obviously Sartre does tie in with the left and does tie in with anarchism or anarcho-communism. So I suppose, what does a world where there is no inherent meaning, there is no test going on for a better world, how does that either fuel or dampen down enthusiasm for a more, I wouldn't say utopian society, but a society which is democratically controlled? If you're going to be the Übermensch, if you're going to be the Superman, to use the Nazis' interpretation, and we can all hope to, you know, better ourselves in a very enlightened manner, how does that tie in with anarchism? Will?
So, like, I suppose the thing that confuses me about some nihilists is they say something like the world has no meaning, as if like that's no one claims the world inherently has meaning, right? Like, no one is making this claim. I've never found someone that says, like, they see a mountain and they go, oh, it's infused with meaning. No one thinks that meaning exists outside of like human attribution of it, right? Like, this is like a human phenomenon. It'd be kind of weird to do. I suppose, like, a thing that a lot of religious people do is they'll try and use their value system to relieve the angst of suffering. And when you remove like God and stuff from it, then that's really that suffering is kind of heightened in a way. I suppose, like, the thing that anarchism is good at when it comes to rejecting these depth commitments is it helps us realize that a lot of the world as is created is an extension of human mind. So, like, that's a really Hegelian thought. So, like, when you see a building and what you're seeing is like the thought processes of a single, well, not normally a single person, but various people made manifest externally, those buildings therefore take on a meaning. They're like, they have like permanence. And there are permanent structures of mind made manifest externally in the world. And when you realize that this is an intersubjective project, you know, like, as human beings, we try and express our personalities via our property, our personal property, not our private property, and via our actions. And then, like, those things gesture towards some sort of underlying agency that we have. So when you lose the idea that the world is God's creation and buildings are God's creation and like everything was divinely inspired in some way, I suppose like you can relocate those same things to humanity, and that will allow us to see each other as individuals who are bearers of dignity and have a moral worth. And if you recognize a person's inherent moral worth without having that tethered to the notion of a God, then that allows us to humanize each other again and perhaps like stop treating each other in such a brutal fashion. At that point, you don't need an external authority, right? You just like, you just have each other, you just have yourself. You don't need a kind of government to tell you, you shouldn't kill that person because you, it's against the law. I asked my kids this week, if the law crumbled, would you murder the person next to you? Like, is the only thing preventing you from killing the person next to you the existence of a law? And they all said no, except one kid, like a quiet kid, was like, yeah. So that was kind of terrifying. But I think that's true. I think like people don't need the law really, because we've got these other like psychological signifiers that enable us to see each other as people. So I think that's what
it comes to. Just to say that one child is obviously a psychopath. So
that one child needs to be watched. Like, I think we can all agree that they are a kind of a concern for me now.
That child will eventually get syphilis and retreat up into the mountains.
Nietzsche hated women. Like, you know, earlier you were talking about nihilism and like how a lot of incels are nihilists and stuff. Nietzsche also hated women. Like, he said, when you talk to a woman, bring a whip and all this kind of shit. Like, he was horrible. Like, he was not a very good feminist. Not very woke was Nietzsche.
No, exactly. James.
Yeah, but isn't that why something like what we're talking about is important? Because, you know, some people, I think, are just kind of born bad. But they're like the Ted Bundys of the world, basically, where they're just sort of born a little bit wrong. And, you know, that's a discussion for another time.
They're no right.
What's that?
They're no right. They're just
no right. Yeah, exactly. But it just happened, like, you know, because...
Like the whole point...
Like what?
Like Begbie.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, I think that's just, you know, like, we've never said anarchism is going to be a utopia. Like, the whole... If we ever had the state that we were looking for, it would still be filled with misery and strife and fucking about and being bored and murder and things like that. Because, you know, that's just what it is. That's, you know, some people are just born slightly to off-center. But what society... that we live in does is encourage psychopathic behavior and encourages people to be like this. So that kid that you're talking about there, like, he lives in the UK in 2020, which is like specifically designed to make someone fucking absolutely touched in the head. And, you know, like, America's a good example of that. Again, like, why is there so many school shootings in America and there isn't in Canada? It's like, you know, 1 to 30, I think, is the ratio there. And it's because you don't live in America. You sort of survive in America. And so, it, you know, once you live in such a dehumanized society, then that's what it creates. So... Like, what I think is good about the Ubermensch, and I know, like, as you were saying, it gets done into the Superman mythos, which I think, I do not think is a good translation of it. But, like, what he's trying to say there, what Nietzsche's trying to say, is that, like, you can create your own morality outside of the one that exists. And I think that's what we should be doing as anarchists, because the morality that we have in... now is that someone who's out in the street, it's inherently their fault and they're somehow at risk. It's their fault and they're somehow to blame for it. It's some sort of fault in their character, where we're saying, no, it's the fault of the system. It's not something inherently wrong with their, you know, the deserving and the undeserving poor argument.
I think also just to kind of bring it back to the question about how it ties in anarchism is... Like, basically, if in a world where you have to create meaning and you have to try and replace that kind of hacked off limb of religion, which gave you a sense of comfort, the only thing that will actually restore that, essentially, that sense of purpose, that sense of comfort, is you creating a world in the here and now. They used to call it the Republic of Heaven kind of ideology, which is basically create a world that you would have wanted to have ended up in. If you died and gone to this other world that you were talking about for thousands of years. So how do you create that? Well, it's up to you to create that. And it's up to you to kind of act in what you think is a moral manner. Now, that might mean rewriting morality. Because for the most part, I'm going to say something controversial, which is morality is something that has been in flux. For example, if you were living in Viking Norway, murder was not a crime, at least not always the case. You know, murder and killing of a person, you know, there's a difference between those two things. You know, you could kill a person, you'd be fine. Murder in certain circumstances, not. So we have to maybe, like James said, go, you know, if we want to, I suppose if you provide the type of meaning that people need in life, you have to do somewhat what Nietzsche did without becoming an incel, which is, yes, maybe the idea of going into the wilderness is a good idea. And if you look into the history of revolutionary movements from Lenin, who ended up surprisingly not that far away from where Nietzsche was in Switzerland during his exiled period. If you look into Irish history, people like William Butler Yeats, revolutionary leaders, were all, for the most part, in the political wilderness for 20-odd years. And the left, I think, right now powerfully needs to come up with a better way of doing what it's doing. It's failed so many different ways. And I think it's because we're fighting on the wrong terrain. We don't have really, I don't know, we don't have the language, we don't have the words, we don't have the ideas, really. And so I think there is something there to be said for, you know, what Nietzsche did anyway, aside for his misogyny and his madness and his inceldom. There's something to be learned for anarchism, and for the left in general.
So I'm going to be mega controversial and say that we need to be like less horny for Nietzsche. So like Nietzsche was an elitist, right? So like Nietzsche thought the problem with our current morality system was it imposed a structure upon all human beings. And this structure would either help facilitate the flourishing or it would frustrate the flourishing of some people. If you were what he would term as a weak person, it would facilitate your flourishing because it basically keeps stronger people in check through mechanisms of guilt and all that kind of stuff. If you are a strong person, it's going to warp and deform your psychology because it's going to try and trick you into thinking you are a being different from the being that you are. It's going to trick the strong into thinking they're weak. Nietzsche was also an individualist, right? So like Nietzsche thought the strong were basically those people that could forge values for themselves. And they weren't bound by what he termed slave morality because they weren't slaves. They were like morally better, morally stronger than the rest of us. And they just should not be held to the same moral standard as everyone else because they were just better, right? So Nietzsche is not a friend of anarchists. He hated communists. He hated socialists. And he hated these things because he was a really, really aggressive individualist. We can accept Nietzsche's criticisms of Christianity and like in many of the same ways that some like democratic socialists will accept Marx's criticisms of capital, but they don't agree with the thing that comes after that. And I think we need to kind of have a similar attitude towards Nietzsche. When it comes to like ethics and like how do we go about forming our ethics, I think like without meaning to be horny for Aristotle all the time, Aristotle's, in my view, spot on. So Aristotle thought ethics was just a function of what it was to be a person. He thought being a person was a functional type of thing. If you want to understand what it is to be a good person, you need to try and understand what that thing's function is. Aristotle gets that horribly wrong. Like Aristotle just thinks people are rational. That's the thing people are. And he means something technical by rational. But I still think he's wrong about that. Marx and Hegel are both neo-Aristotelians in that they both think that kind of project is about right. Marx thought people were something, he referred to people's essence as their species being, and he thought people were fundamentally productive. And capitalism frustrated that productive mechanism in us because it reduces us to mere cogs in a machine. I suppose like that was a long-winded way of saying we should be less horny for Nietzsche. Sorry.
Yeah, it should be pointed out, though, that Aristotle also believed that slaves were inherently slavish and the ruling class were inherently ruling classes, you know? So in senses like that, like, he got a lot wrong.
Oh, yeah, like, I mean, Aristotle's a cretin, right? Like, no one is denying Aristotle was cretinous. He thought women were like, flesh-shaped plants. So Aristotle, obviously wrong.
Can you stop for a second? That's very funny. If horrible.
Hegel's got this quote that says, as man is to animal, woman is to plant. So like, this isn't a kind of like many Western philosophers who come out of that tradition were not cool people at all. So Aristotle the man and a lot of his writings are absolutely hideous. Aristotelianism, the project, I think is pretty decent to my mind. And actually, when I talk to other anarchists and I kind of go through this, like most anarchists the most anarchists I find do not agree with Aristotle, but they are Aristotelian, I suppose is what I'd say. Nietzsche was Aristotelian.
I need to drag this back towards the topic again, because we're now going into Aristotelian.
So sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So basically focusing on, again, some common accepted ideas of what nihilism is. We don't have to go down into what actually it is. It's obviously complicated and has different meanings and blah, blah, blah. We've definitely gone over that. Can we talk about what was bad that came out of nihilism? Now, again, you might say, well, people like Hitler who misread, you know, the will to power, which was edited by his sister, who made it very, very nationalistic and racist, which he certainly did. He walked out in the middle of the ring. What was it? The Wagner thing about the ring. What's it called?
The ring cycle. Yeah, he walked out of Parsifal as well.
He walked in and then broke off his friendship with Wagner. So, you know, that's, you know, not his fault. But there are things in there, much like Jordan Peterson. You know, in fact, he's like, Peterson's like a really dumbed down Nietzsche in many ways. Way less literate or interesting to read. But anyway, there's a lot of the same things there. So why is it that these bad things come out of nihilism in quotation marks? Again, in quotation marks, Will. So please do not go on another rant about why it's not nihilism. Commonly perceptions of what nihilism is. Why are these bad things coming out of it in terms of, other than the fact that Nietzsche's sister was a racist? Does anyone want to jump on that?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, yeah. We're very bad for going on long rants that start very, like a good couple of hundred years before we lead up to the point. But it's because we're all like historical materialists. So you usually have to start with like, the answer is like, well, it all started in the Neolithic period. But I think like the reason that things went bad is because you have to put yourself back into the thought of what it was like to be in the feudal society if you weren't at the top, which was, you know, it was all about community to some extent, but it was a very oppressive community. And, you know, you didn't really exist. Like you could only go to as far as you walked in a day. And that's pretty much, you know, the village up the road. So your worldview was, for most people, like extremely limited. Your life was dictated by the church and your feudal lord. And depending on what they were like, most likely a complete fucking nutter dictated your life. And so this radical idea of individual freedom that happens in the 19th century is quite radical at the time, and it must have been like a big sense of relief for lots of people. You know, if you had, say, like gone to Jesuit school and had done your training there, or, you know, if you had gone to Oxford to get your training, you know, these really difficult and quite patriarchal societies were quite inhibiting. And so this idea of like, oh, you could do what you want, for more and more people was quite nice. And in the same way that, say, like if you're on a diet and you're not eating chocolate, when you get to the end of the diet, you don't just go like, oh, I'm just gonna have one piece of chocolate and that'll be me. You tend to go fucking hog wild for it and over binge on it. And I think that's basically what happened, is we've been going down this path of like free radicalism, individualism to the extreme extent, and now it's time that we really need to start putting the reins and start getting our diet back more to a healthy center.
Yeah, but I mean, that might touch on somewhat what I said, but more specifically, let's burrow down in there. Why is it that so many people within national, I'm not going to call it national socialism because it wasn't socialism, but, you know, fascism, why are so many people drawn to these ideas of Übermensch? Now, again, Übermensch mistranslated, you know, much more about the overcoming man, somebody who's kind of taking hold of their destiny rather than the kind of Superman thing and the Untermensch and the Übermensch. You know, why is it that those ideas are so distorted? Now, maybe that's a very general question. And in fact, all ideologies and all ideas are distorted in the minds of the people and simplified and made into some type of racial thing. But Will, can you answer why are these bad things coming out of quotation marks nihilism?
Yeah, I'm not really, I don't know, like, I suppose the kind of, I suppose it maybe related back to something James said earlier, which was about like the psychopathy of capitalism. And like the kid in my class who said that she would do a murder if there wasn't any law saying so. Yeah, like that was kind of terrifying. But I wonder if like, if you've got this nihilistic view that anything goes, and then you structure an economy around about that, and you structure an economy where the success condition is acquisitiveness and power, then the kind of person you are going to get, they're going to think of themselves as an Übermensch because they rise to the top of this kind of this pile. I'll keep my point super short because, like, I don't mean to bore everyone. But the thing that James said earlier on put me in mind of, like, you know the film American Psycho? I think that's a really great film. I know that's, like, not a cool thing to say, but, like, I genuinely think this is really great. Because it kind of shows you, if this is the way the world is structured and these are the success conditions in place, this is the kind of person you are going to create. Like, this person is just a really adapted, super well-fitted character type that operates within this world. It's like deterritorialized, it has no value structure at all, and they're not bound by like what we would recognize as any semblance of moral norms or hyper-individualistic. They're very consumerist, and it's all about like simulacra. It's not about like having any underlying meaning behind anything. It's all like really psychopathic. So yeah, just like when James was talking earlier on about capitalist psychopathy, it put me in mind of the film American Psycho, which everyone should watch. It's about capitalism. Watch it. It's good.
Okay, well, I'll give an attempt at why these people are drawn to this. And I think it's the same reason why people who are in sales now are drawn to Peterson and ideas like that, which is it gives you an out. It says, okay, you've had a miserable childhood, you've had a miserable teenage years, you were bullied, you were put into a corner, or you retreated into that corner. You need a reason to, A, understand why that happened. Okay, the world's out to get you. B, okay, I need to overcome it. I need to become a Superman. And again, misreading of Nietzsche and those ideas. Life is meaningless. I create the own meaning in my life. Therefore, what type of society do I want? I want a society where people are regimented, where, you know, again, you can see how a set of people, Hitler obviously being the most obvious, could adopt those ideas. But even within, you know, Stalinism, it's the same idea. Why? Obviously, it's a much smaller group of people. And the top, basically just Stalin and a terrified group of yes men that he hadn't shot yet. But, you know, a lot of those same ideas are there. And I do think it's important to understand that, you know, there's a reason why people across the political spectrum, left and right, were drawn to ideas of Nietzsche's ideas, and people who were religious and not religious were both drawn to those ideas too, which is, yeah, it's empowering. But at the same time, who are you empowering? And what weapons are you giving to them? Now, again, that's not Nietzsche's fault. Nietzsche has many other things to be, you know, to be blamed for. He doesn't need to be blamed for fascism. That's his sister, I think, maybe, who certainly helped them along those roads. But there's also good things, which we talked about as well. I am aware, though, that we've been talking now almost for an hour. I suppose what we could try and do to finish up for a last kind of segment would be, how can nihilism, what are the good things about nihilism that we can use, I suppose, in the here and now for those who are on the left? And how can we control the negatives that are there as well? If you wanted to, and really what we're talking about is existentialism, not nihilism. I'm aware, Will, I can see your face. You know, how can existentialism really more than nihilism, you know, how come that can be employed in a good way? given what we're facing in the here and now.
So like there's like nothing good about nihilism. I hate it. It's like the worst. I suppose like what's good about existentialism is it, I suppose it forces you to take some personal responsibility, which is good. How do we counteract this? We get people to remember that other people exist and that your personhood is contingent upon you recognizing other people and other people recognizing you. So like if I were a chess player, and you were to compliment my chess, assuming you're not very good at chess and I'm very good at chess, which is probably the inverse of true, I would not respect you if you told me I was good at chess, but I would respect someone who is equally or better at chess telling me I was a good chess player. So you can only respect the esteem others hold you in if you respect the people who hold you in that esteem. So how do we counteract nihilism? We remind people that it's unsatisfying to be an individual where you do not recognize the status of other individuals.
Cool. James, you want to have a go?
That was nice and succinct. I quite like that as a philosophy to go with. Well, what I think is good about it is what I said earlier, is I think it's your first step on radical views. And I, you know, what this podcast is about and is for is, you know, in some ways it's propaganding our point of view. It's to give people a library of stuff. You know, maybe, you know, it's dialectical because we're not always agreeing with ourselves in the same podcast. And sometimes we contradict what we say a couple of podcasts down the line. But it's sort of like we're going on a little journey, and hopefully our very very nice and great listeners are along on it with us as we chop and change ideas, and we can take what we like from stuff and leave other stuff. But I think it's important that we have the strength to have our own morals that exist outside of the one that we're in now, because it's not getting us anywhere and it's not doing us any favors. And that might include doing difficult things that, you know, we were born not to do. Now, what they can be, I'm not going to say because it probably gets us into trouble. But, you know, what I would say is, you know, how did the IRA in the 20s get to their point? You know, you need to do, you need to have things to fall back on, and to, you need that sense that you're doing the right thing, because if you're not, then you're going to falter. And if we want to live on a planet that is going to, you know, be livable for our children and our grandchildren, it might require some really radical actions, and we'll need some strength to pull up on to do that. And so something like nihilism will help you attain that, hopefully, anyway.
I think to just finish off and to feed off what James just said, the IRA of the 1920s, if anyone's listening to this, not the 1970s, because that will get us cancelled. Anyway, but to feed off what James said, I do think that there, given the propensity to conspiracy theory and delusion and nationalism to some extent in the world now, a deconstructing and accepting of that those things are delusions or illusions is very important. And so if Nietzsche did any of those things, if anyone who was an existentialist or, you know, or anything along those lines taught people how to deconstruct these types of illusions and try and build something that was at least based on fact. I know that Nietzsche didn't do that because he was mad. but if we can find a way to deconstruct things and look at things, I suppose, in a I don't want to say academic way, but in a kind of logical way, and build something at least that is for the benefits of the many, not the few. Thank you, Mr. Corbyn. then there's something positive from it, and we can try and create something better. That sounds way less erudite than Will's, but I don't particularly care because we've been talking for a long while. So our listeners will hopefully look at the bottom of the podcast and see some links to more information about nihilism and existentialism, which is really what we were talking about for most of this podcast, and also Mr. Nietzsche, because I have a lovely documentary which goes into how he was just a really big incel who had sex like once and got syphilis, which is so fucking funny that I don't even I can't even, yeah, I can't even think of something funnier than that. Hopefully you like and share the podcast on Twitter and on whatever else you use. That's going to be goodbye from me with my Twitter handle, the Incel of Sils Maria. Look at the podcast. I'd look at the notes at the bottom and you'll learn why that is funny. Will, who's been the gayest of all sciences.
Bye, everyone.
And
I have no vote, sorry.
That's okay. And of course, James, who's thus queefed Zarathustra.
As well, folks, if you've got any subjects that you want us to cover or have a look at, feel free to pop us an email or pop us a DM on Twitter or something like that.
On that note, guys, we're going to say goodbye. Bye.
See you, folks. Have a powerful weekend.